care of a shopping list. Eggs, milk, bread, 100,000 units of Kristang-powered armor, paper towels, a bottle of single malt scotch, tomato sauce. Oh, you noticed the odd item in there? Yeah, the scotch is for me. It's not on the official shopping list. You don't mean the scotch? Then what? Okay, yes, the real shopping list was all about gear the Alien Legion needed. We had everything the Legion would need. Mech suits, rifles, ammo, mortars, spare parts. Everything a well-dressed spaceborne cavalry soldier needs for a wild night on the town. The problem was, we didn't have enough of it. Not even enough to fully outfit our own people. Now that our force structure had been augmented by Verdcris volunteers, we needed a lot more equipment. The number of Verds who immediately signed up was far greater than we had capacity to handle. We were limited by the capacity of transport ships available and the lack of infrastructure on Fob Jaguar to support a large number of aliens. All the food the Verds would need had to be transported to the forward operating base, and before the alien troops could begin training, they had to construct a base, including housing for all of them. The Verds were eager to get on with training and stated they could sleep on the ground under tarps, but their own leaders agreed with us that living in primitive conditions would harm combat readiness. So, the first 2 weeks after the Verdcris landed at Jaguar, they worked tirelessly to set up a sprawling base of their own. Anyway, our alien allies were tired of playing Bob the Builder and wanted to play G.I. Joe. I mean the G.I. Joe with the amazing kung fu grip, not gastroenterologist Joe. Nobody wants to play with that action figure. So, General Ross, or his logistics staff, had given us a long shopping list of gear required to equip our own people and the Verds. The original plan for a shopping expedition assumed we would need to bring whatever Navy ships were available, plus at least one assault carrier, and raid a Kristang planet. Such a raid would take weeks to plan and train for, plus we would first have to identify a target and conduct a recon. All that took time we didn't have, time the merry band of pirates didn't have. The ongoing requirements for Valkyrie and the Dutchman to support the Navy and Legion were diverting us from our own mission, hitting the Maxulks hard. We had just stopped at a Theranan relay station to get updated intel, and my sanity was unraveling over the problem, when Skippy's avatar popped up on my desk. "Why so glum, Joe? Tomorrow is Taco Tuesday!" Taco Tuesday is proof that God loves us. But, I pushed away my laptop. All the targets for this shopping trip will take too much freaking time. I thought you loved shopping. When did you get that idea? You offered to go shopping with Margaret when you were on vacation. The two of you wandered around stores for hours. That's different. She wanted to go shopping, and I wanted to be with her. I like to see her happy, you know? I guess so, he shrugged. You don't like shopping? No. I don't mind it. Like, I don't mind going to a hardware store. Shopping is different for guys, Skippy. For women, shopping is like a movement to contact. They go to see what is there, then analyze their options. For me, shopping is a raid. I establish clear objectives before I leave the starting line, hopefully gather all the intel I need beforehand. Like, does the store have what I want in stock? Once I go through the door, I want to know the exact route to the objective without wandering through the stationary aisle or whatever. When I have what I came for, I want to egress as soon as possible. Got it? What about all the impulse buy crap you usually get at the register? Those are targets of opportunity, I muttered. Right. Well, I might have good news for you. Please don't screw with me. This is for reals, homeboy. I might have found a one-stop solution to all your shopping needs. Does this include free delivery? Sadly, no. Do you want to hear about it anyway? Hell yes. Colonel Jeremy Smythe had two problems. Three, if you count that he was bored out of his mind. The first problem was that his nose was itching, and had been itching since just before he put the mech suit helmet on. In hindsight, he should have scratched it before sealing the faceplate, but something always itched while wearing a mech suit, and experience had told him he could ignore it until it went away. In better hindsight, the designers of the suit should have included a nose scratcher feature. Perhaps Skippy could modify one of the creepy little repair bots that were stored in the back of the helmet's neck to come out and scratch wherever the user indicated. He could simply pop open the faceplate to quickly rub his nose. A brief exposure to vacuum wouldn't be harmful. but he would be violating protocol and showing weakness in view of the team. That simply would not do. He could live with the itching. It gave him something to think about. The second problem was the nagging thought that maybe, just maybe, he was getting too old for this shit. Colonels should properly be leading the team, not on the front line. He justified his presence because it was the first time the Stars had attempted this particular type of operation, but then almost everything the Stars did was unique. In his backpack was a container that held one end of a micro-wormhole, the other end connected back to Valkyrie, so he could have provided leadership from his office. Yes, it was possible that a catastrophic event could sever the micro-wormhole and leave the away team to their own resources, but any event that cut a space-time rift would likely result in loss of the away personnel. Why was he there? Because he could see the end coming. Not an end for humanity. He had more faith in the merry band of pirates to entertain the notion that the last problem could not be solved, nor did he foresee an end to the merry band of pirates. Earth was building a navy and had a new alliance with the Verdkris, or at least with some of them. Regardless of what conventional arms humanity acquired, there would always be a need for a special operations unit, and he firmly believed the pirates were the finest in the galaxy. The end he saw coming was an end to his participation not only in away missions, but to his time as a pirate. Eventually, he would be pulled upstairs to command a unit more suitable for a full colonel, and his life would become an endless treadmill of training others, meetings, and paperwork. So damn it, he wanted one last rodeo, as the Americans would say it. Someone was humming. "Major Frey, is that you?" he prodded gently.
"Sorry," she sighed. "Didn't realize I was humming aloud. I have a song stuck in my head.
I have an itch on my nose.
This is a song I absolutely hate."
"What is it?"
"Sir, you do not want to know that. If it got stuck in your head, you would hate me."
"It might take my mind off my itchy nose," he chuckled. "Hit me with it."
"Okay, but don't say I didn't warn you."
"Skippy, sing."
An alarm blared, and a radiation indicator flashed a warning in his visor. It might have been his imagination, but he thought he felt a ripple run through him, making his suit rock gently. That was impossible. There was nothing in interstellar space to transmit a vibration.
"Woohoo!"
Skippy exulted over the link from Valkyrie.
"It's showtime, boys and girls! Wow, I outdid myself this time. That ship jumped in 14 meters from the site I selected. Okay, sure, part of that was luck, but even then..."
"Coordinates, please," Smythe prodded the AI before he got distracted.
"Huh? Oh, yeah. Sending coordinates to you now. The Delta V is at the upper limit for your maneuvering units. You had better get moving."
The six members of the Star Team were wrapped in one large, rigid foam shell for protection against the burst radiation that occurred when a starship tore a hole in space-time and jumped in near them. The portable stealth field with them had bent most of the high-energy photons around them, and the foam shell had absorbed most of what leaked through. Some radiation did penetrate the stealth field and the foam shell and made the armor of their suits fluoresce briefly, but the dosage was not anything harmful. When Bishop had proposed his latest lunatic idea, Smythe had a flashback to when René Giraud and his team were caught outside the Dutchman, too close to a jump wormhole. Between being caught in the space-time distortion and the intense radiation, that team had taken weeks to recuperate enough to resume training. This time, Skippy had assured Smythe, or tried to assure him, the situation would be different. Yes, the Stars would deliberately be placing themselves near the coordinates where a Theranan star carrier was expected to emerge. Yes, because the star carrier would be hauling a nearly full complement of starships, it would be creating an especially high-energy wormhole. Yes, there was a chance the star carrier would emerge behind the star team and smack right into them before any of them knew something had happened. All of those things were true. But, Skippy insisted, he had everything totally under control. Probably. A solid shmaybe, at the very least. He knew roughly when the star carrier was scheduled to arrive, and he knew the coordinates it was aiming to jump into. He couldn't do anything to narrow the time window, but he could make the enemy ship emerge within a very specific area. By planting one end of six micro-wormholes near the center of the aiming post and projecting an especially flat area of space-time, he could assure the star carrier would emerge right there within a bubble 800 meters across. And the damned arrogant beer can was right. The star carrier emerged almost exactly where Skippy predicted. It was 3 hours late, well within the window of probability. All that was good. The only negative Smythe could see was that the star carrier's pre-jump momentum was making it coast away near the limit of the speed the jetpacks of the star team could match. Moving quickly in a well-practiced synchronized motion, the six stars got the foam shell taken apart and fed into a bag that crushed the foam into a ball half a meter in diameter. If the bag fell outside the stealth field, it would be detected by the star carrier, so Grudzian strapped it to his chest and authorized his jetpack to perform the next maneuver. On a signal from Major Frey, all six jetpacks began to thrust in unison. 38 minutes later, still in the tight stealth field, the stars were slowing to match speed with the massive star carrier. They were moving at only 2 meters per second relative to their target that loomed above them, a Kristang transport ship that belonged to the Fire Dragon clan. The transport's containers were stuffed full of everything an aspiring invasion force could want, particularly powered armor suits that were state-of-the-art for Kristang technology, plus rifles and crates full of ammunition. The destination of the ship was not a Fire Dragon world that was threatened by the ongoing civil war, nor were the weapons intended to be used by the Fire Dragons or one of their subclans to invade an enemy world. The weapons would be given to both sides involved in a dispute on a planet being contested by clans who had allied against the Fire Dragons. Those two clans could bleed each other dry, fighting over a world that no one really cared about, and killing each other would mean they were too busy to cause trouble for the Fire Dragons. The senior leaders of the Fire Dragons were patting themselves on the back and giving themselves substantial bonuses for their cleverness at developing such a low-cost solution to a nagging problem. "Okay," Skippy whispered in Smythe's ear so low it was difficult to hear over the faint hissing of air in the helmet vents. "You're approaching the sweet spot now." "Skippy," Smythe did not take his eyes off the synthetic view from behind the all-enveloping stealth field. "You do not need to whisper. Is there any sign we have been detected?" "Nope, quite the opposite. With all the traffic out there right now, the star carrier is using only passive sensors, other than guidance beams. You could probably turn off the stealth field and nobody would see you, unless some lizard was looking out a window. I mean, we will not be doing that," Smythe said dryly. "Yes, good idea. Seriously, three ships have detached and are maneuvering away. The Theranin are distracted by screaming at the Kristang for being sloppy. Plus, they have bots out checking the pylons and doing basic maintenance on one of the reactors. Man, they complain about the lizards being sloppy, but Skippy, do you have any relevant information to share?" "Sorry. No, you're good." "Wow, we've come a long way, huh? Not that long ago, the thought of being near a Theranin starship would be frightening, and now you are..." "Will you shut up, please?" "Gotcha." If anyone had been looking out a window, or if the AI of the star carrier had been paying particularly close attention, they might have noticed the skin of the transport ship's boxy cargo containers appeared to ripple slightly. The effect was barely noticeable and only lasted a second. Still, anyone seeing the event would have at least thought it was weird. Fortunately, no one was looking, so no one guessed the ripple effect was caused by a localized stealth field approaching the ship. The star team slowly drifted between cargo containers attached to the transport ship's hull. 3, 2, 1, halt, Frey intoned quietly. We've stopped. The hull is 6 meters in front of us. Choi, Smythe called to the operator in front of the formation. You're up. Ready, Choi acknowledged. And 2, 1, launch. He fired the pistol, which used a gentle magnetic pulse to launch the grapple forward outside the stealth field. Trailing a thin cable, the grapple splattered softly against the hull of the ship, spreading out to latch onto and around anything within its grasp. Verifying the grapple was secured, Choi began slowly reeling in the cable, jostled by the other 5-star operators who were tethered to him. Moments later, he turned off the reel mechanism and flipped around for his boots to contact the hull. The airlock is over here, Frey called, shining her helmet light on the door that was outlined in bright yellow and red. Inside the stealth field, the lights of their suits provided the only illumination, and even that was distorted as the photons were curving to follow the field around them.
Grudzian, ditch the basketball and get over here.
Right, the Polish operator grunted, glad to be rid of the ball of compressed foam. I'm sure not going to miss that thing.
Well, shit,
Skippy muttered a few minutes later.
What is wrong? Smythe demanded.
They had drilled into the airlock's outer door to feed a thin wire inside so Skippy could hack into the local sensor bus. As he had reminded them, Kristang's systems were too primitive to hack into remotely, so he had to be jacked in directly. Once he had control of the local wiring, they were able to cycle through the airlock two at a time without the ship's crew or AI knowing the airlock was active. Following instructions, they had pulled themselves along dingy, poorly lit passageways into zero gravity until they reached a data port where Skippy could be jacked in. He had assured them that from that one data port, he could worm his way into every system aboard the ship, taking complete control, locking out the crew, and preventing the Theranin from realizing anything was wrong. Except something was wrong.
Crap, this stupid data port isn't connected to anything.
Smythe clamped down on his instinctive anger, his professional training taking over.
What do you suggest?
I guess you could try another data port. There is one forward and one aft. If this one is dead, it's a pretty safe bet everything aft of it is also offline.
Moving forward cautiously, leapfrogging each other in a cover formation, the team went forward along the passageway, which looked even dingier on close inspection.
Damn it, Frey cursed, pointing at a data port with her free hand. This one is completely missing.
Where there should have been a port was only a tangle of optic cables extending from the bulkhead.
Ruh-roh,
Skippy muttered.
I gotta be honest, I'm not optimistic at this point. There is one more data port forward of you, but be careful. The blast door that leads to the forward section of the ship is near that data port. Any lizard looking through the view window in the door could see you.
Right, Smythe considered. Lights off. Switch to infrared. Grudzian, you're in the lead with Choi. Romero, Ling, take rear guard for now.
The third time was not a charm. A data port existed, even with scuff marks showing reasonably recent use, but it was dead.
Damn it, Skippy groaned. Crap! No Joy here.
Choi, Grudzian, pull back, Smythe ordered.
Though his team did not have any of their suit lights on, a shaft of light was coming from the half-meter-wide window in the blast door. The chameleon wear of the mech suits made it difficult even for the enhanced vision of Smythe's visor to detect the outlines of his two operators, but an alert Kristang peering through the blast door might see something, such as the dust bunnies kicked up by the stars. That was a complication that had not been anticipated, and Skippy had no solution for it. The passageway apparently had not been cleaned since the ship was constructed. Sticky grime and dust were everywhere. The grime helped keep some of the dust from floating around, but the humans moving through the passageway had disturbed clumps of the stuff, and a snowstorm of gray balls of fluff were swirling in the air. Swirling everywhere except for the spaces occupied by the operators whose suit repulsor fields kept pushing the dust away, which only made it more obvious that something was in the passageway. Choi and Grudzian began falling back until Frey hissed at them.
Freeze!
A shadow fell across the window in the blast door, and something or someone went past. Waiting for a heart-stopping 3 seconds, Frey said a silent prayer that whoever or whatever it was that had gone left to right in front of the door kept going. She had the best view, extending her rifle out into the passageway from the alcove where she had taken shelter.
Now, move, she breathed.
The two stars wasted no time flying down the narrow access tube, being caught by their fellows and pulled back into alcoves.
Skippy, Smythe took a deep breath to calm his mind. Options, please.
Geez, I don't know. It now looks like two relays blew out a while ago, and rather than spending the money to replace them, the crew just stopped maintaining the data connections after the bulkhead forward of you. Stupid lizards. Without full sensor coverage of the central section of the ship, they could blow out something important, like a power conduit. I hope one of them is nearby when one of the conduits...
Skippy, focus.
Right. Sorry about that. Well, I know the data ports in the forward section are working. There is one less than 3 meters to the left of the blast door on the inside, of course.
Darn it.
That data port doesn't have to be working for the ship to fly. Ugh. These stupid lizards might have bypassed the entire system and are running the ship on cables taped to the freaking ceiling. In that case, we are screwed, dude. Of course, when I say we, I mean you, because assume the data port nearest the blast door is non-functional. Where is the closest port that must be online for the ship to be flight-worthy?
That would be in the ship's control center. But if you're in there, you could...
Understood. Smythe pulled up the ship's schematics on his visor. The door to the control center could be, should be, closed and locked if the lizards were paying attention when the Star Team got the blast door opened. The control center was not an option, unless... No, he pushed that thought from his mind. Consider the best option first. It looks like there is another data port 15 meters straight ahead past the blast door.
Correct, Skippy agreed slowly. If the original builder's schematics are correct, that is a big risk, considering what we have already found aboard this piece of crap. Also, the data port you referred to is not actually essential to the operation of the ship. It feeds the forward crew accommodations. And, also, I should remind you, we don't know if that network is still in use. Like I said, the lizards could have bypassed the whole thing.
Is there any way for you to check from here? Smythe meant through the micro-wormhole event horizon in his backpack.
No, sorry, Skippy sighed. With the micro-wormhole and its containment shell, I don't have the range to inspect that part of the ship. Remember, the Krestang harden their networks to an extreme extent so their asshole patrons can't screw with them so easily. You could open the containment chamber, but the built-up Cherenkov radiation would set off alarms all over the ship and the Star Carrier.
Damn it, I should have considered that and included a... Is there any way we could check whether the native network has been bypassed?
Well, I suppose one of you could just look through the window in the blast door. Take a video, I mean.
Choi. Smythe selected the Korean-American operator who was closest to the passageway. We need eyes through that window.
On it.
Choi swung around the corner and expertly pushed himself off to soar along the center of the passageway. Giving himself a little push with one hand to avoid landing on the window directly, he used both hands to cushion the impact and moved his left hand around to give a view through the window from his wrist camera.
Okay. Oh, this is not good, Skippy mumbled.
Smythe knew what the AI meant without needing to ask. Bundles of multicolored cables were attached to the ceiling running along the top of one wall. Near the bottom of the wall were a line of scorch marks and several sooty, pockmarked holes.
See? Skippy was disgusted. They did blow out a power conduit. Serves them right, stupid lizards.
What does this mean? Smythe asked.
It means to take over this ship, you need to go into the control center and, you know, take control.
How long would it take the crew to close the door to the bridge?
Unfortunately, less time than it takes the blast door in front of you to cycle open. Assuming that blast door even can open, I mean. From the amount of dust in that passageway, I don't think anyone has been in there for a long time. To access the aft section of the ship, the crew might just use the enclosed railings along the exterior of the hull.
Smythe thought for a moment. He had encountered more difficulties on previous missions, but at some point he would have to be prepared to call the mission a failure and pull his team out.
Can we test the blast door mechanism?
Not without an alert sounding in the control center. I could silence that alarm if I was jacked into the ship, but...
Right. Team, ideas?
Can we blow a hole in the blast door?
Grudzian suggested.
You could, Skippy huffed.
The overpressure in that narrow passageway might kill or at least disable you. Plus, the explosion would automatically cause the control center door to close.
There is... another problem.
Smythe gritted his teeth.
What?
The Therenin just received a signal from the local relay station that there will not be any ships attaching to the Star Carrier here. They just ordered the 3 ships that detached to accelerate away because the Star Carrier plans to jump soon.
Checking the counter in his visor, Smythe swore. That is too soon. Standard Theranan procedure.
Yeah, they are pissed off at the Krestang, so they're cutting it short this time. Sorry.
He looked back down the passageway, mentally calculating how long it would take to get back to the airlock.
Can you prevent the Star Carrier from jumping?
No.
Well, I could, but I'm not there, am I? I said you should have brought me with you, but no. Stupid Joe says Skippy has to stay aboard the freaking ship while you monkeys go have all the fun. It's not...
We can't risk you being captured, and you know it. You can't extend your presence through the wormhole?
I am extending my presence, but I have to be careful. If I extend my presence enough to begin hacking into the Krestang transport ship, the Theranan Star Carrier will detect me before I am ready. That's why I need you to jack me into the transport ship directly. Really, what we should have done is...
Right. Smythe had not time to indulge in what-if scenarios. Do we have time to scrub the mission? And
no, again, I am sorry. The Theranan will sweep the area with active sensors before they jump, and they will detect you regardless of the stealth field. Also, you do not have time to get far enough away to be protected from the radiation of the jump wormhole.
The... Smythe, this is Bishop. The general's voice broke in. This mission is a bust. Valkyrie is preparing to launch railguns and slice that Star Carrier in half. It's not jumping anywhere.
Sir, please hold, Smythe requested.
The Theranan will self-destruct if they think their ship is at risk of being taken. There are also two Theranan cruisers attached to the carrier that could complicate matters. If there is a fight, we would lose this ship, the equipment aboard, and possibly my team. Not if you get into escape pods before we shoot. There are two escape pods in the aft section. You can get to...
Excuse me, sir. Given what we have seen of this ship, I am not confident the escape pods are at all functional.
Okay, Bishop admitted. You have a good point. What's your plan?
We try doing this quietly. Smythe's grip tightened on his rifle. Now we'll do it the noisy way.
Chapter 24.
I can't guarantee the timing of this will work, Skippy warned. If the door to the control center is like everything else aboard this ship, it will get jammed halfway closed. But it might be the one thing the stupid lizards took proper care of.
We understand.
Smythe checked the positions of his team one last time. He would have liked them to be closer to the blast door, but the narrow passageway was too confined to leave anyone exposed to possible blowback. Grudzian and Choi had the lead, positioned in a shallow alcove 10 meters aft of the heavy door. In case they were injured by the explosion, Ling and Romero were standing by as backup.
Skippy, are you ready?
Affirmative, the AI said with a bit too much enthusiasm.
I will inform the Theranan Star Carrier that this ship has experienced a power conduit rupture. That is totally believable.
Outstanding. Team, we go in 3, 2, 1.
He eye-clicked to set off the detonator.
Now.
In a circle 2 meters across, a blinding light appeared on the aft side of the blast door as the thermite nanocord ignited, burning white-hot. The superheated plasma burned through the door in less than 2 seconds, then a shaped charge in the center of the now-detached circle exploded, kicking the circle forward into the passageway. Grudzian had a brief view of the glowing hot circle of ceramic composites bouncing away up the passageway, then the whole area was clouded in a spray of fire-retardant chemicals. His suit switched to active sensor mode, sending out steady pulses to provide a view as good as if the air was not wreathed in fog. Moving as soon as the charge created a hole in the blast door, he leapt forward, going through the hole and clearing the cherry red edge by centimeters on one side. His momentum carried him forward, and he used his left shoulder to take the impact on the bulkhead, extending his feet to clamp boots firmly to the deck. Choi was right behind him. Grudzian swung his rifle up from the low-ready position to sight on the control room door that was sliding the last few millimeters closed. The instant Choi's boots touched the deck, Grudzian launched 2 rockets in rapid series from his rifle's undermount tube. The first projectile was armor-piercing. When its tip contacted the door, a shaped charge in the rear of the warhead exploded, kicking forward a tungsten slug that instantly flashed into plasma when it slammed into the tough material of the door. The composites of the door were indeed tough, but were intended to protect against shrapnel and loss of air pressure, not against weapons designed to penetrate military-grade armor.
The warhead's plasma burned a 2-millimeter hole through the control center door, sending the remaining plasma to splatter around the compartment like a deadly fountain. The air in the control center instantly was raised enough to scorch the lungs of anyone who breathed in, and moisture in the air flashed into steam. Right behind the first rocket, the second was set to fragmentation mode. It adjusted its course in flight, aiming for the new hole in the door, which was too small for the warhead. That was not a problem, for the warhead was composed of bomblets no larger than grains of sand. As the warhead struck the too small hole, it split open, sending half of its payload forward. Those deadly sand grains flew forward a pre-programmed 3 meters before exploding, sending shards outward like a powder that sliced into everything they touched, including the 5 exposed Kristang in the control center, who were killed instantly. Choi followed up by sending another anti-personnel rocket into the door. If that rocket's warhead was disappointed to find the targets already a bloody mess, it did not say anything.
"Clearing a hole," Choi warned, launching a 4th rocket that struck the door and created a 12-centimeter hole.
Grudzi and I clicked a command in his visor, and an object the size and rough shape of a moth was spat out from his backpack.
"Drone is away."
The tiny drone flew toward the door, hesitated as a hot fragment drifted across its path, then zipped through into the control center.
"I can't see anything in there," the Polish special operator muttered.
"Switching to active mode."
"We have movement,"
he warned, moments before the drone reported no life signs within the compartment. The movement was debris floating around, colliding and bouncing off shattered consoles that were sending sparks into the foul air.
"All targets down. Repeat, all targets are down."
"Get that door open,"
Smythe ordered as he came through the still-hot hole in the blast door behind Grudzian.
"Frey, watch our backs."
Trying to get the control room door open was a waste of time. The mechanism was melted, and the door too warped to slide back into its slot. Major Frey waited with Petty Officer Romero and Lieutenant Ling while Choi set thermite cord onto the stubborn door. She observed that action only in a window on the upper right corner of her visor. Her focus was looking forward down the passageway to the left of the blast door. Romero and Ling were moving straight forward, covering each other as they cleared compartments. If any opposition appeared, it was likely to come from the crew accommodations in the nose of the ship behind the sensor dome where...
"Hello," she whispered. "I have movement here."
Something had popped around the intersection of a passageway, then disappeared. The fire extinguishers had shut off, but fine droplets of foam still hung in the air, and unfortunately coated every surface, including her metsuit. The repulsor field around her only made the foam dance, rendering her more visible, so she had shut it off.
"Do you need backup?" Smythe called.
"Negative."
She wasn't sure what she'd seen, and just then she saw it again. A lizard, wearing an environment suit hood, poked his head around the corner. He wasn't equipped with a mech suit. That was good, although her enhanced vision detected the muzzle of a rifle.
"You're a little late to the party, pal."
Just then, crewman Curious George poked his head and shoulders around the corner, bringing his rifle up, just as Frey double-tapped him in the forehead. He was flung backward, disappearing back up the passageway in a spray of blood. Red droplets joined the gray fire retardant fog.
"One down,"
she reported, watching the lost enemy rifle bounce off the rear bulkhead and slowly flip end over end back up the passageway to join its former owner. From behind her, she sensed intense heat. The door to the control room was being burned through. She had a momentary fraction of a second's distraction, just as another Kristang came around the corner. This crewman was not Curious George. He was Pissed Off George. Blindly spraying rounds from his rifle, he died, as 4 rounds impacted his unprotected chest, ripping a hole the size of a bowling ball clear through his torso.
"2 down," she reported. "I'm fine."
Her suit was not showing any impacts. The undisciplined enemy fire had only chewed up the rear wall and the ceiling.
"That might be all of them," Skippy said. "Ships like this have a nominal complement of 9 crew, but clearly the owners of this rust bucket have been cutting corners.
I'll know in a moment, as Lieutenant Choi is finally about to jack me into a data port. And yes, I am in, baby!
Hang on, everyone. This could be a wild ride."
The transport ship rocked, sending a vibration through the deck plates as Skippy fired thrusters on the belly and both sides of the ship. He could not fire the main drive with it in cold shutdown, and he didn't need to. There was another shudder, harder, then a groaning, tearing sound. Ships attached to the hardpoint docking platforms could not detach on their own. That action had to be authorized by the Theranan Star Carrier's crew. The Theranan did not want any idiot starship crews deciding on their own when to fly away, and especially they did not trust their inferior client species. Skippy could have released the transport ship by himself if he had control of the Star Carrier, which he did not. The reason he was not permitted to seize control of the Theranan ship were well-reasoned and sound and blah-blah-blah monkeys didn't want him to have any fun. When the blast door had been, well, blasted open, the Theranan immediately began screaming at the transport's crew to explain what the hell was going on. Of course, with the door leading out of the control center sliding shut and the passageway beyond filling with a fog of fire retardant, the crew replied honestly that they didn't know, but they feared something aboard the ship had suffered a catastrophic failure and they were in the process of analyzing the problem. The two ship captains were in the process of arguing about which of them was more of an asshole, with the Theranan making several good points, when the audio feed from the transport ship was cut off with the distinctive sound of an explosion. Pretending to be the transport ship's captain once he was jacked in, Skippy shouted that some of the crew were committing mutiny. He added convincing sound effects of gunfire and requested urgently that the Theranan send assistance immediately. The Theranan had a good laugh at that. Why should they care if a bunch of lizards killed each other? The laughing stopped when some idiot aboard the transport began firing thrusters, not only firing them on full, but firing them in a sequence that rocked the piece of junk transport side to side and set up a dangerous vibration in the pylon that attached it to the Star Carrier. Katie Frey's helmet smacked against the bulkhead behind her when the ship lurched suddenly. Skippy shouted with joy.
We're free! Emergency separation complete! Okay, firing thrusters to get clear—
Uh-oh. The Theranan are threatening to shoot at you.
Well, go ahead, jackasses. If this ship explodes close by, it will damage your shiny new Star Carrier.
Switching to a private channel, he added, Are you all right, Major Frey? You bumped your head there.
I'm fine. The suspensor field in the helmet cushioned my head. Give us a jump countdown, please.
Sure thing. Colonel Smythe just asked me for the same thing.
Oopsie. The Theranan are detaching one of the Krestang frigates to chase you. That ship could make trouble. Still no damping field being projected by the Star Carrier. That's good news.
Cutting thrusters. I'm sending a signal that the mutiny has been suppressed and everything's fine now.
Wow. The Theranan are really upset. Maybe I should jump you away sooner rather than later. The pinheads might still shoot at you.
That's Colonel Smythe's call.
No, actually it's mine and you are jumping now.
Skippy!
I stared at him, holding up my hands in amazement.
What the hell? Where did the ship go?
The transport had jumped away, and we lost the micro-wormhole connection to Smythe's team.
I am not exactly sure, Joe.
You're not sure?
Okay, truthfully, I have no idea. They could be anywhere, really. Anywhere close. They couldn't have jumped far.
Why did you— Because the Theranan were charging their proximity defense cannons and getting ready to shred the transport ship. They wanted to make an example for other Krestang. I couldn't wait. I had to jump them away. With the mass of the Star Carrier and other ships so close, it distorted the jump field.
So you have no freaking clue where our people are?
I will have a clue if you shut up and let me analyze the wonky jump signature.
I have to exclude the effects of— His voice trailed off into unintelligible mumbling.
Aha! Quit your grinning and drop your linen. I found 'em.
Probably. Sending coordinates to the Flying Dutchman now.
Kong,
I called my counterpart.
Programming jump now, Chang replied. If this data is right, they only jumped 17 light minutes.
Joe, we can't latch on that quickly. In about 16 minutes, that Star Carrier will know where the transport ship went.
Yeah, well, that Star Carrier isn't going anywhere. I gestured behind me for our gunnery officer.
Colonel Mamet.
Before he could respond, Nagatha spoke.
General Bishop, please do not do anything rash.
I felt my cheeks redden as the kindly AI of the Dutchman admonished me.
I believe I can program the transport ship for another jump of a greater distance. Then we can latch on to them when we have more time.
Sir? Sims prompted me. I rubbed my chin, considering. We have what we came here for. I'm reluctant to take risks for secondary objectives.
Joe, Chang said, give me 10 minutes. If we can't make that ship jump on its own, we'll come back here, and you will have plenty of time to destroy that star carrier.
Everyone was waiting for me to make a decision.
Skippy, you figured out where that starship jumped to. Can the Theranin do the same?
He snorted.
No way, Jose. First, they aren't smart enough, and second, their sensors got scrambled by jump distortion. They don't have any data to work with.
You're sure about that?
100%.
Bilby drawled. Like, if anyone cares, I agree with Skippy. The effects of that jump on ships in that area was bad, like, gnarly, dude. That star carrier is probably trying to figure out whether they have serious damage.
Trust your people, I reminded myself. That is something I had to tell myself too often.
Kong, go get our people. Bring them back safe.
You got it, Joe. Dutchman jumping,
The signal was cut off when the micro-wormhole link in our ships was severed.
Waiting sucks. The Flying Dutchman did not jump back to us in 10 minutes. That was a good sign. Unless it meant something very bad happened, and because we are the Merry Band of Pirates, that wouldn't have surprised me. Mame kept his finger on the trigger, and I watched the display anxiously. We saw the gamma ray burst from where the transport ship departed from 17 minutes after it disappeared. A few minutes later, there was another flare of gamma rays at the same location from a different ship with the Kristang signature. Skippy identified the second ship as the Dutchman, and Bilby confirmed. The drive had been adjusted to mimic that of a Kristang cruiser, and Skippy was pleased with the results. Okay, so the Dutchman had gotten there and found the transport ship. That did not mean Smythe's team was safe. Had Chang waited too long, hoping Nagatha could guide the other ship to a proper jump? We wouldn't know, damn it. 4 minutes after the first gamma rays were detected, the star carrier jumped. I didn't have to guess where it went. If the transport hadn't been able to jump away, Chang and Smythe would be caught in a bad spot. And I had to wait, or demonstrate that I did not trust my people and ruin the careful planning of the operation. And 11 minutes after we detected the gamma rays, we picked up 2 more Kristang jump signatures. Our people had gotten away before the star carrier knew they were there.
See? I turned to Sims casually.
Piece of cake.
Your faith is inspiring, she muttered, managing to say it without an eye roll.
Mame, stand down, I ordered with a shudder of relief.
Weapons are standing down.
He sounded relieved, too. We waited 3 hours before jumping away to make certain the star carrier never knew we had been lurking near them the whole time. The Dutchman was waiting for us at the rendezvous point with the dingy transport ship attached awkwardly along the port side.
Kong, it looks like you've been hanging out in a bad neighborhood.
The transport ship truly did look like a piece of crap.
Tell me you have good news.
Sir, this is Smythe, another voice answered. The bell might not look like much, but it is full of quality toys for good girls and boys.
He was unusually cheery.
That is outstanding. Keep some toys for yourself. I will take you up on that offer, sir.
What is the bell? I asked.
The name of the ship is Bells Are Ringing to Celebrate the Achievements of Postar von Dindon. Apparently he is a minor clan official who owns the ship.
Hey, well, sadly, this had been a bad day for porn star Van Dingdong.
Yes, it is, Smythe laughed, and he went on laughing.
It's good to hear you enjoying yourself, Smythe.
Thank you, sir.
Joe?
Chang was laughing, too.
We did it.
Yes, we did.
I thought we were done with sneaking around, but it pays to keep our skills fresh, huh?
When planning the operation, one option was for Valkyrie to jump in, disable the star carrier with maser beams, slicing through the spine, and demand the surrender of the transport ship we wanted. That was a low-risk option. At least, low risk to us. Unfortunately, the Theranin were very likely to give us the finger by self-destructing their ship, and we would get nothing for our effort. Skippy did not know when we would have another opportunity for convenient one-stop shopping,
so using brute force was really not an option. That was when Smythe, with help from Skippy and some jackass named Bishop, came up with the lunatic idea for a star team to wait in a freaking foam bubble for a star carrier to jump in on top of their heads. Anyway, it worked. Plus, we accomplished the secondary objective. We sowed distrust between the Krestang and Theranin, more than usual, I mean. The Fire Dragons were slowly grinding their way to winning the Civil War, and they would now find it much more expensive for the Theranin to haul their ships between stars. That would hopefully prolong the Civil War, which, if you think about it, makes me kind of an asshole. Whatever. It's not like the lizards needed an excuse to kill each other. Finally, with the weapons we stole not going to ramp up the conflict on some Krestang planet I didn't care about, the fighting there would settle down sooner rather than later. That would leave both clans there available to cause trouble for the Fire Dragons, which, see my previous point. It was nice not to have to sneak around all the time, but it can still be useful. I learned a lesson from the taking of that ship. I had made the operation too complicated by combining multiple objectives. To avoid the Theranin knowing that humans were involved, Skippy had to be quiet about hacking into the transport ship. That added the major complication of him needing to be physically jacked in rather than using his full range of magic, and that put the Star Team's lives in danger. In the future, I would not make that mistake again. Outstanding job, everyone, I concluded. Kong will send a relief crew over to the porn star Van Ding Dong. Smythe, come back to Valkyrie if you have everything secure over there. The ship is secure. Great. One last question, please.
Sir?
Smythe asked warily. What song did Frey have stuck in her head?
Ah!
Frey groaned. I just got rid of it. Now it's back. Hey! Skippy interrupted. I think I know which song. Don't. She was too late. Skippy started into a song that my grandmother hated. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. I'm an idiot for asking. That song was stuck in my head all day. Margaret and I were lying on my bunk in my living quarters at Club Skippy after we delivered a literal shipload of mech suits and weapons for the Legion. Idly stroking her shoulder, I was staring at the ceiling. What? She raised her head off my chest. Huh? You have a goofy smile on your face. Being called goofy is not what a guy wants to hear when he's in bed with a woman. Joe, she tapped a finger on the tip of my nose. In this case, goofy is a good thing. Cute is a good thing. Gotcha. What are you thinking about?
Nothing.
Nothing?
I'm just... I kissed her.
Happy, that's all.
Of course, she snorted.
You just had sex.
I'm serious. I mean, not just happy about this, you know.
Sims says the crew is calling you Angry Joe.
I'm angry too, but right now I'm happy. The problems we have, we can fix them. We have kinetic darts now. We're going to use the Maxulks' own weapons against them, and they will clean up that damned cloud. We're going to hit them so fucking hard they will beg us to stop before the whole galaxy knows how weak they are.
I hope you're right. That's why you're happy? You can see an end to this mess?
Not just that, but yeah, that's a big part of it. It's nice just seeing you. Getting regular shore leave. Last night I had dinner with my parents, and it was almost normal. Yesterday morning I went fishing with my dad. I could feel her stiffen.
You didn't eat the fish, did you?
No.
The native life on Jia Yuguan didn't provide nutrition to humans. We couldn't digest the proteins. It was mostly catch and release. She relaxed a bit.
Mostly?
We threw back the big ones. Dad kept some of the smaller fish to use as fertilizer in the garden. He said the soil conditioner they're using will make the fish break down into minerals anyway. Fishing isn't about catching fish.
It's about drinking beer?
She giggled.
Man, it is weird hearing Gunnery Sergeant Adams giggle. It is also nice to hear her giggle.
A couple cold brewskis can be part of it, yeah. You women can just get together for coffee. Guys need to be doing something, fishing or watching sports, something like that. You're hanging out, but
You're doing something. That's what golf is about.
I thought it was about chasing a stupid little white ball.
That's just an excuse. If you're having a good day, it can be about the golf. But there are rarely good days on the course. It's about being with friends.
And then drinking beer in the clubhouse.
Well, yeah.
Joe.
She rolled on her side, so she looked me in the eye.
You really think these darts can make a difference?
A rod of ultra-dense material moving at 3/4 the speed of light? Hell yes. Just one of those can do a lot of damage, and Skippy thinks there are plenty of darts out there waiting for us like ripe apples on a tree. We just have to take them.
Skippy thinks?
She knew from painful experience that Skippy was sometimes overconfident. He's sure of it now. We found one group of them pretty much where he predicted they would be. Don't worry about Valkyrie. We'll handle our part of the mission. How are the Mavericks shaping up?
The Mavericks aren't the problem. The unit is basically a headquarters platoon with a security element. The problem is the rest of the new expeditionary force. Most of these people are still amazed to be on an alien planet. They have no off-world combat experience. I hope wherever we're going to hit first, it's an easy target.
That's the plan, yes.
You can't give me a hint?
You know I can't. I shouldn't.
You can ask Perkins if she wants to bring you in on the planning.
She will have to soon.
I'll wait until she's ready. How are the two of you getting along?
She's smart, and she's tough.
I wouldn't want to get in her way.
You trust her?
Unless I get in her way.
That's not what I asked.
She takes care of her people. I'm one of her people now.
Good. My Z-phone beeped softly, alerting me that I had a meeting with General Ross in 90 minutes. We got ourselves disentangled, and I slid off the bunk, walking toward the housing unit's small bathroom. I'm taking a quick shower. Do you want to grab lunch?
Depends.
She propped herself on one elbow, not covering herself with the sheet.
Will we be sitting together?
Depends. Am I allowed at the cool kids' table? I winked.
I'm serious.
She tossed her head, and strands of wavy hair fell over her face.
In here, she pointed at the bed. You're Joe. In the DFAC, you are General Bishop.
Yes, I am Brigadier General Bishop of Skippistan, assigned to the Special Mission Group. You are Gunnery Sergeant Adams of the Special Tactics Assault Regiment, currently seconded to the Mavericks as their Special Ops Liaison.
I'm not your CO.
We don't even serve in the same armed forces.
People will talk anyway.
Her previously blissful expression faded.
People are talking about us now.
You know everyone refers to us as Marjo? She frowned.
I hate that name.
It's better than Jogrit.
True.
She laughed and lifted one eyebrow at me.
What? I'm admiring your buns.
That did not make me feel self-conscious at all. Thanks. I could feel my cheeks redden, the cheeks on my face.
I'm a lucky girl.
I'm a lucky guy, I said, as I took a step toward the shower.
Joe?
Yes?
Do you really need lunch?
In fact, I did not. Chapter 25. It was time for the new people assigned to A Company of the 1st Battalion, 125th Spaceborne Cavalry Brigade, the company commonly known as the Mavericks, to get their dropship acclimation flight. Many of the new soldiers shrugged when they saw the exercise listed on their Z-phones. After all, they had flown up to Earth orbit in a dropship, and the landing at Fob Jaguar was on a dropship of one type or another. Sirjet Jaites assured his team that they would be simulating a combat drop, landing in a hot LZ, followed by a short march, then reboarding the dropship as quickly as possible before a flight back into orbit. They would repeat the trip a second time, three times if the schedule allowed. The exercise would be nothing like flights they had experienced previously.
This is listed as a familiarization flight, so we won't be simulating damage to the ship or enemy shelling the LZ from orbit. Your armored suits won't freeze with the simulated battle damage, and the pilots have been instructed not to exceed standard G-force limits and no crazy shit like flying upside down. However, he growled, making sure everyone was looking straight at him. We don't have time for sightseeing, so we are going to treat this as a combat drop. Are there any questions?
Hands went up. Narrowing his eyes, he looked from one end of the formation to the other.
Are there any questions that won't make you look like a fool and piss me off?
All the hands went down.
That's better. Assembly is at 2415.
The planet, called either Fob Geoyuguan, Jaguar, or just Club Skippy, had a day that was 25 hours and 7 minutes long, according to Earth standard. Rather than stretching the local day across 24 increments, UNEF had tacked on an extra hour and included 7 leap minutes just before midnight. The compromise didn't make anyone happy, but it was something relatively harmless for soldiers to complain about, so there wasn't any incentive to make changes. The ride up to the assault carrier UNS Hudson Bay CV-03 was no different from the flight most of the team remembered from leaving Earth. For all of them, that had been their first time in space, and if they had noticed the interior of the dropship was well-worn back then, it had been lost in the excitement of going off-world. Their second flight from the surface of a planet into orbit had a bit less novelty to it, so they were able to pay attention to the scuff marks on the deck, the stains on the seats, and the safety webbing, and hear an annoying high-pitched sound of something vibrating in the cabin ceiling. The pilots took it easy on the flight up to the assault carrier, which had yet to go through refit. Only one of the cavernous landing bays was operational, the others either torn apart or filled with spare parts, or had dropships crammed in nose to tail, still not yet unpacked from delivery by the Jarapha. Crews had to go over the dropships one by one when they had time. Time was the problem everywhere for both the Human Expeditionary Force and for the Alien Legion who outnumbered the humans. Earth was in danger of freezing, not imminent danger, but that didn't matter to any member of the X-Force who were eager to get on with it. They had to wait for their obsolete second-hand starships and dropships to be modified for use by humans and to be upgraded, so they weren't simply target practice for every hostile group of aliens who wanted to prove the upstart humans weren't so tough after all. While the starship crews were busy trying to figure out how their new ships should be operated, the Space Cav and Alien Legion were busy training to use their new equipment and learning the new doctrine and tactics for combat assaults and ground operations. It would have been nice if the extra 1 hour and 7 minutes in each day could be allotted to sleep, but no one had time for that. When the Scarab dropship docked aboard the Hudson Bay, Jaites opted to skip the step of making everyone get out and boarding by the numbers. He knew there would be plenty of time for that exercise while an assault carrier was en route to whatever planet the Legion planned to hit first. If UNEF leadership had selected their first target, that information had not trickled down to his level, and he knew to ignore the various bullshit flying around the human and Verd rumor mills. After a brief time to refuel the dropship, it was moved into a launch tube. There were whirring and banging sounds as the pilots cycled equipment in a pre-flight check, and heart rates of the team rose, especially when the ship was jolted as the launcher clamps engaged. The team displayed admirable discipline by not filling the common channel with useless chatter. Then, suddenly, there was no breath available for speaking as the heavy dropship was propelled out into space and beyond the artificial gravity field. UNEF training guidelines called for the first familiarization flight to be relatively gentle, but the key word was relatively. There was a lot of flexibility in the guidelines, and Jaites had requested the pilots to push the limit. Bored with shuttling Space Cav soldiers up and down and needing stick time in their new dropship, the pilots were happy to oblige. That is why, as the cabin echoed with a roaring sound and shook from aerodynamic pressure that weighed the passengers down 3 times the force of Earth gravity, the soldier seated opposite Jaites bit her lip and was breathing hard through her nose.
"Specialist Carter," Jaites barked. "This is a training flight. If you're going to puke, open your helmet."
The pilots and dropship crew chief would not like hearing that. But if soldiers upchucked in their helmets, Jaites would be responsible for seeing that each set of powered armor was properly serviced. Besides, while a suit helmet had the ability to clean itself, that was not a pleasant process, and UNEF regs stated it should be avoided unless it was dangerous or impossible to open the faceplate.
"Sorry, Sergeant,"
Carter grunted, her face turning pale as the dropship banked hard, flipping on one side, then swinging back.
"Oh, no."
She hastily swung the faceplate up and out of the way. Jaites contemplated the goo that was running over the deck plating toward his boots.
He didn't bother to lift his feet, and since his own helmet was sealed, the smell didn't get to him.
Carter, that was weak.
Sorry,
she mumbled, miserable.
Hey, Jates,
Dave Chyka called over the private channel from the front of the cabin.
You shouldn't have called her
weak,
Jates repeated.
Look at Rivera here.
He pointed to a soldier seated on his side of the cabin, four seats toward the front of the cabin.
He managed to puke all the way onto the opposite cabin wall. That is impressive.
Oh, whew.
Carter was still concentrating on keeping what was left of her dinner on the inside. Jates stirred the muck with the toe of his boot.
This squishy stuff could be anything. But what are these greasy green chunks? I don't remember seeing that in the chow hall.
Seeing the green chunks of whatever was too much for Carter, she ralphed again.
That's more like it.
Jates watched his suit automatically shed the offending material from his thighs onto the deck.
Can everyone hear me? Don't you have any pride in this outfit? If you're going to spew, put some effort into it.
Three more people followed Carter's example as the scarab slammed into the atmosphere at 3.5 gravities, then bounced so they were temporarily in free fall.
Shit, Jates, Dave laughed. I see what you did there.
Give me some credit, Chyka. Better for people to get the nausea out of the way on a practice run than when someone's shooting at us.
And maybe next time we won't have to tell them not to eat a big dinner before a combat drop,
Dave said, having limited himself to crackers and a handful of peanuts.
Man, I am sure glad I don't have to clean this ship when we're done with it.
Dave was wrong. Not about the wisdom of eating a small, bland meal before experiencing any sort of zero-G or wild flying maneuvers. About not having to clean the dropship's cabin. The crew chief, appalled by the mess, declared that was the last time his precious ship would be flying the Mavericks, especially their security platoon. Jates partially solved the problem by suggesting they simulate a hull breach while the dropship approached the Hudson Bay again. He instructed everyone aboard to seal up their suits. Then the crew chief cycled open the rear ramp. Exposure to hard vacuum freeze-dried the offending material, making it easier to scrape up. By the time the scarab was on final approach, the crew chief was no longer glaring daggers at Jates and his team. Until they did it all over again. Gunnery Sergeant Margaret Adams checked her phone as it beeped with a message. She was to report to the base supply area to be issued her new gear. There was no rush, according to the message, but she knew the supply section was still in total disarray and she would be lucky if they could find half of the gear she was supposed to have. Since joining the Mavericks, she had been training with second-hand equipment, some of which didn't fit her properly. In the chaotic cluster of tents and shipping containers that constituted the Special Operations Supply Section of Forward Operating Base Jaguar, she used her Z-phone to guide her to the clerks who made her sign for everything that UNEF thought she needed, an ordeal that took 3 hours. In the end, she needed an electric cart and two Army specialists to haul everything over to her side of the base, and she still hadn't seen the specially fitted mech suit that was supposed to have been delivered. It was waiting for her inside the containerized housing unit she called home. There were two crates, each 2 meters by one, with locks encoded to her biometrics. What she should have done was stow all the gear she had already checked out, including securing her STARS rifle and the Maverick's armory. But with two large crates mostly filling her housing unit, it was best to try the suit on first, then it could be stowed away properly. Besides, she was curious. The crates popped open when she pressed her palm to the scanner, and the two specialists eagerly crowded her to see what was inside. She dismissed them, partly because they were annoying, and partly because she would need to get undressed to don the suit liner. Tugging open the crate that contained the mech suit's torso with the backpack power cells, she froze, talking into her Z-phone.
Skippy, what is this?
Hello, Margaret. Do you like it? He asked in the tone he used when he wanted to be praised for something he'd done.
Pretty cool, huh?
What is it?
A Special Operations Multipurpose Powered Armor Suit, Mark 7.
Mark 7? We're on the Mark 5.
You were using the Mark 5.
She stepped closer, examining the torso and the detached arms that were packed into the bottom of the crate. The suit was bigger, bulkier. Instead of the satin finish of a typical Cristang mech suit, the new unit's surface was a dull matte,
although there were tiny glints of light reflecting from it, like it was coated with a fine layer of soot and diamond dust.
Colonel Smythe didn't say anything about this. The last time we—
Smythe doesn't know about it, Skippy chuckled.
Star Team Alpha is testing the Mark VI now. There was only enough fabrication capacity at Ragnar to make one of these new suits, and I want you to have this prototype. It—
prototype?
She stared at the thing, aghast.
You want me going into combat in an experimental design?
No, maybe I should not have said prototype. This is more like a pre-production example with—
That is not any better, Skippy. Give me my old Mark V back, please.
Jeez. No can do. Sorry, your old suit has been split up as spare parts. I had to recycle some of the nanomaterial to make Mark VIs for ST Alpha.
Skippy, that is not acceptable. Do you understand that?
Actually, no. Although it is based on a standard Kristang form, most of the Mark VII is built on Max Hulk's technology. The suit is bigger, stronger, has tougher armor, and the power cells last almost 40% longer, even with increased power consumption. It has an advanced chameleon-wear skin, plus a built-in stealth field generator. Although, admittedly, the stealth field only can be used for 33 minutes before it burns out, I'm working on stretching the useful life of the generator. With all that, the suit overall weighs 12 kilos less than a Mark V.
I don't understand why you don't like it.
Because it's new and untested, and I've never—
New, yes. Untested, no.
This is the Mark VII Delta. It includes refinements I discovered were needed during testing of the Alpha through Charlie versions. It has been extensively tested.
By a human?
Well, no, but then it hasn't been tested.
Okay, good point. That is why you need it now.
Skippy, I'm not a test pilot, or whatever you call it. Colonel Smythe's team should be evaluating this new model, not me. ST Alpha needs this equipment more than—
No, they do not.
Skippy, you're not listening to me. I'm not special. I don't need special treat—
You are special, he insisted.
This isn't about—
Perhaps I should have said your current assignment is special.
Smythe's people are supported by other Tier 1 operators, and they have the incomparable magnificence of me with them. You are the only operator assigned to the Mavericks. If they get into trouble, and they always do, you need every advantage you can get because I won't be there to help.
But,
hey, you were constantly telling Joe that a soldier should never turn down anything that gives you an advantage on the battlefield, right?
Yes, she sighed, irritated at having her own words thrown back at her.
I hear all your very good reasons why I should have this supersuit. What I don't hear is the real reason you made this suit for me.
What is that?
Because I'm special to you. Listen, Skippy, the Army or the Marines, we are a team. There are no cowboys, no superstars. We succeed because we put the team first.
Fine, he huffed.
Then put me first.
Huh?
I don't ask much from you monkeys. Amuse me, listen to me sing, and I will protect your filthy species.
Listen, Margaret, try the new suit, please. If you don't like it, I can make adjustments while I'm still here. There are other Mark V units available, although I can't imagine why you would want to downgrade.
You promise?
I promise.
She looked at the suit again. There was no reason she couldn't at least test the new design.
Damn it, the thing looked cool.
Okay, Skippy, I will try it. You need to send the user manual first. The Dash 10 is on your phone. Although I designed the user interface so the transition should be seamless for you, you should only notice the difference at the margins. The Mark VII has substantially higher limits in terms of speed, protection, and—
Will it have an annoying AI that talks to me?
No, I learned my lesson about that.
The suit has an AI, of course, and it can be voice-activated, but only on user command.
Good.
Now, she tugged on the torso, but it was securely attached to the crate.
I need people in here to help me get into this thing.
No need for that, Skippy chuckled as the top of the crate swung back and the torso rose so its bottom was a meter and a half off the floor. Just attach the arms, then get into the torso from the bottom.
Margaret?
Yes?
If there is anything you don't like about the suit, please let me know. I will be able to make adjustments. But once Valkyrie leaves again, you are on your own.
Oh, Ottavio Scarandum grunted. Why, this is not suspicious at all.
What?
Lieutenant Kinsta looked up expectantly. Their ship had just pinged a relay station for an update, and he had not seen any priority message traffic for them. Remember after the humans first attacked the Ruhar at... He searched his memory. Rentino?
Their first action was at Castornal, the aide corrected his captain. Rentino was second. I still say both of those actions were technically not attacks, but
yes. Well, Scarandum waved an antenna, irritated. Remember at the time I asked you whether any of us guessed that humans would attack the Ruhar? He shook his head, still incredulous at the development.
Kinsta blinked.
The answer was no. Central Wagering did not have a record of, at the time you inquired, Central Wagering did not have a record of anyone placing such a wager. They do now.
Ah, Kinsta sucked in a breath.
Who?
Scarandum had to check his notes again. A Captain Federatan of the Star Carrier Let It Ride.
It's a civilian ship, he added when he saw the blank look on the junior officer's face.
Federatan and her crew supposedly placed several wagers at their last reported stop. Most of the wagers placed out of the money. But those lucky bastards, Kinsta swore, burning with jealousy, before looking at Scarandum sharply.
Sir, why did you say this is suspicious?
Because the Let It Ride was stopped by the ghost ship Valkyrie and seized along with 5 Ruhar transport ships. Just after Captain Federatan and her crew supposedly placed the fateful wager about what move the humans would make next. A correct wager.
Supposedly?
Kinsta was confused.
The wagers were not registered?
They were properly registered. The one-time authentication tags were received by Central Wagering 6 days after the humans invaded Castornal.
Kinsta thought of arguing that Castornal had not actually been invaded, but kept his mouth shut.
Well, Captain Federatan and her crew certainly are lucky then.
Too lucky.
Sir?
Doesn't this sound suspicious to you? The only people who correctly wagered what the humans would do are the same people who encountered the humans a few days later.
But...
Kinsta's antennas dropped, then stood straight up in alarm.
You are not, he sputtered.
You are not suggesting that someone faked an authentication tag.
That was impossible.
I am saying this sounds like something we would do, if we could, he added.
Authentication tags can only be used once. They can't be faked.
They can't be faked by us. We know the humans somehow hacked the quantum state interchanger system of the Maxulks. That system was also considered to be unbreakable.
But, the integrity of authentication tag technology is the basis of our civilization.
Kinsta shuddered with horror. That is why, the ECO captain lowered his voice, though the two of them were in his office with the door closed. We are not going to say anything about the subject.
I do not want to believe it.
I don't either.
Also, why would the humans fake a wager on behalf of Federatan and her crew? They could have simply taken her star carrier and left her in an escape pod.
Yes. Instead, they allowed her people and all the Ruhar of the transport ships to depart in one transport. Kinsta, is it possible that the humans are simply decent people?
Or they just want to screw with us, Kinsta muttered.
Eh. Scarandum's antennas dipped in a shrug. It is more likely they do not wish to sour relations with us in hope of a future alliance.
Well, there is nothing we can do about it now.
No, but there is one thing I am doing while we are still in range of this relay station.
What?
Scarandum took a one-time authentication tag from a pocket and waved it in the air. I am registering a wager that our system for recording wagers is not unbreakable.
Sir Jet Jates held up a standard Kristang infantry rifle designated M25A5 by UNEF. To say it was standard was not quite correct.
The weapon had been modified extensively over the term of its service with both the original Alien Legion and by the special mission unit calling themselves the Merry Band of Pirates. The A-5 model was issued to both human spacecav units and the Verdcris of the Alien Legion, and was only slightly different from the M25A9 model used by the special operators of both species. Jates did not care that a selected group of operators had a fancier rifle. He only cared that the knuckle-headed humans he was in charge of gained experience with their new toy without causing injury to themselves, each other, or him. Based on what he had seen so far in the training cycle, he was not confident the primitive aliens could be trusted to handle lethal weapons, and the boastful bravado he'd heard from them left him disgusted that anyone who had yet to see combat could brag about what they were going to do someday. He held a rifle aloft.
"For your benefit, I will dumb this way down. You may think of this as a bang stick."
The murmuring of the crowd was not friendly, except for Staff Sergeants Jared and Coulter covering their mouths to stifle laughter.
"The pointy end," he pointed to the M25's muzzle, "is not to be aimed at any of your fellow idiots, and never at me. Is that clear? In combat, if you do manage to point it in the direction of the enemy, do us all a favor and do not pull this here trigger mechanism. You won't hit anything useful, and all you will accomplish is pissing off the enemy and getting us all killed. If that happens, my ghost will hunt you down and make the afterlife miserable for you forever. Did anyone not understand that?"
2 days later, the new soldiers of the Maverick security platform had an opportunity to fire live rounds with their rifles after shooting unloaded weapons at a simulated firing range. The simulator was supposed to accurately represent the experience of firing live rounds, even making the rifle kick back and the barrel heat up. The fact that the simulator was not an accurate representation became immediately obvious when soldiers who were rated expert in simulations had difficulty hitting the target at all on a real firing range. After a luckless specialist stitched a line of rounds from the edge of his target and across the target of the soldier next to him, Jates had enough.
"Cease fire! Cease fire! Soldier, secure your weapon and get over here."
The target of Jates's wrath sheepishly avoided the big lizard's eyes, did as ordered, and trotted over for a personal counseling session.
"Davidge?"
Jates peered at the man's name tag.
"Specialist Will Davidge," the man acknowledged.